Great. And how long, what time should I be planning to finish?
12:30 is our hard stop.
Okay.
Finish earlier, then we'll all get a little extra time at the lunch.
Yeah. Okay. So it's really been special to be learning with all of you. I really appreciate your passion and your insights and your compassion and the intelligence. Like, I just gained so much from it. Like, if I provide anything, I hope so, but I've definitely gained a lot from all of you, and I really I appreciate all of you, and you give me a lot of hope and inspiration. Of all the presentations that I've made since I'm here, and this is the last one, this is the most basic and the most important in terms of what I think is important for you to be aware of, in terms of things that I've learned in working in hospitals with patients, and just like the things that I quote and need to utilize on a daily basis, the things that took me a long time to learn and I wish, like, I would love to, you know, just to be able to have this, like, summary. So I'm going to, like, share with you, like, my summary of what I've learned so far, and then love to also interact with you and hear about it. I have a few sources I'll show you, but it's more talking, but I want to show you a few things, because the first question is that will lead to my kind of, there's one line that I say with patients, with staff almost every day, actually oftentimes multiple times a day, that's like my most important go-to line that kind of is what's gotten me through the work that I do, and I think provides guidance for families and patients. And I first want to show you just the basics of the sources, not in depth of the source, and then you'll see how it all comes together for this one line that summarizes everything and, like, is the guide for patients in hospitals and especially in end-of-life issues. And so the first question is, from at a principle level, like trying, it's just figuring out principles, to define what does Judaism say. I know Judaism is multivocal, but I'm saying, like, a Jewish approach to the principle of the value of life. What is the value? How do we define the value of life? So, and it might not be clear, but I think it'll become clear as I explain it. There are those who take one view where they'll say that life, you see this oftentimes in medical ethics, Jewish medical ethics books, life is of infinite value. Infinite value. Life is of infinite, supreme value. It's the most important thing. And they base this off the pasuk in Vayikra, Yishmartem es chukosai, mishpatai, asher yaseh osam ha'adam, v'chai behem. V'chai behem, you should live by them. The Torah was given that you should live, prolong life at all costs, or everything you can. V'chai behem, and one of the main sources in Gemara that they quote is the Gemara in Yuma Pehe, Misha Nafal Lav Mapolas. The Misha Nafal Lav Mapolas is that you can be Mechalo Shabbos to save life, even if it's Safek Sham, Safek Enu Sham. If they're going to Safek Chai, Safek Mace, they might be dead, they might be alive, they might not last very long. You can break Shabbos to save a life, any life, and therefore we see that life is of infinite value. And in fact, even if it sounds a little bit extreme to say that, because it is, I think, from my perspective, maybe it's a drop extreme to say, like, life is of infinite value, there's nothing more important than life at all costs, at all times. Can we ever spend, you know, that would mean, if we had a Jewish government, so to speak, you could not spend money on anything else. You can't build parks, you can't, because there can be nothing, you can't justify anything but healthcare spending, because you have to just prolong life at all costs. It's infinite. Is it infinite value to have parks? So, I mean, this would be the argument. It's like, how far do you go with this? You prolong all life at all costs? And even though it might sound like, okay, that's extreme, there is beauty. I just want to say, I don't want to sound like I'm being judgmental. There is beauty to it. For example, the Bir Halacha, there's a classic Bir Halacha in Shin Chav Tes, where he quotes this Gemara in Yuma. By the way, as a side point, if you ever read poskim about medical issues, and the first thing they quote is either V'chai Behem or Gemara Yuma Pehe, you already know, okay, this is where they're going with this. I can see this is going to be a more strict opinion, a more prolonged life at all costs view. But the Bir Halacha there in Pehe just quotes that, and he says, I just think there's a beautiful line here at the bottom here, I underlined it. He says, Lefize bor de filu katam rutsats nami mechalin afapi to lo yishmor shabbosos. The Gemara there says, even the reason you can be mechal Shabbos is because they will yishmor shabbosos harbe. Chalel of Shabbos achas, kdishimoru shabbosos harbe. You break this Shabbos, because then they'll at least observe many more Shabboses. But the Gemara there says, but even if someone's only going to live for a few hours, you could break Shabbos for them. You could save their life. Why? So because they're not going to get more Shabboses. So the Meiri there says, well, maybe they'll do tshuva. Which, by the way, I use this for the story I told you about the boy yesterday who left his yeshiva background and came to LA and died of an overdose. The family, I use it with the family. I said, look, it's worth it for he did tshuva at the end. He was worth it. It was worth the chilul Shabbos of extubating him for the tshuva that he did. Anyways, so you can see how this could be relevant, but that's the Meiri's reason. You could do tshuva. But the Bir Halacha, Mishnah Berurah gives a different reason. It's more intrinsic. It's not just so you can do tshuva. There's actual value to all life. We have to treat all human life equally. It doesn't matter if they can communicate with us, if they can give a lecture, if they can read a book, or if they can't talk, if they're not able to go to school. There's still value in all human life. They can't do tshuva. They'll never be someone who, you know, let's say they have some sort of mental disabilities, that they'll never be considered a gadol by halacha. They'll never be an adult. So afal pi kein mechalalin. Still, you have to be mechalal Shabbos for them, like a cher shot of a katan. Afal gav de ein. It's an onus that they can't fulfill mitzvos, but they still have intrinsic value. I like this source just because it's a source that tells us, like, we have to respect and cherish every human life. And we don't just say it's like, oh, this person's a great, you know, philanthropist or whatever. They're valuable. No, everyone deserves respect, dignity, value. So even though, but this is the school of thought that life is of infinite value. And I'll even give you an anecdote that supports this school of thought, potentially. So just to share, because I think that's the point of the session, is to share some of my experiences. I got a call one day. I remember I answered the phone. This is how the call went. Rabbi, I don't know if you remember me. You did my father's funeral, and now I have to ask you to do my son's funeral. I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. What's going on? She says, well, it's horrible. He had a brain aneurysm. He collapsed. He's not at your hospital. He's at another hospital. And actually, the reason I'm calling now is because the doctors want to take him off of the respirator. And I said, you know, I have to ask a rabbi first. So, Rabbi, I could take him off, right? So I said, well, tell me more. When did he collapse? What? She said, yesterday. I said, yesterday? Yesterday this happened? They already want to extubate now? Like, they're giving up so quickly? And she said, they told me there's no chance. So I said, personally, maybe you've seen the sources this week, but I just felt like I don't know of a heter for that. And I also just felt like, why rush? My experience always is like, let's get a second opinion. Let's take our time. Let's just see how things play out a little bit. I said, can you ask for like another opinion in the hospital and just give it a couple of days? She says, Rabbi, I don't know. I think we have to, you know. I said, well, just ask, because maybe don't rush it. So she says, okay, I'll ask. So then I remember she calls me back Friday. It was just like 2 days later. And she says, Rabbi, I didn't get a second opinion, but they said to me, there's nothing, it's not going to get better. So I was really stuck because I wanted to show compassion. And I also didn't personally know of a heter. I didn't even know who I could call that would give her a heter for this, to extubate in a case where he will die, certainly, as a result, which is what the doctors had told her. So I remember it was Friday, so I said, you know what, let's just give it the weekend. Call me back Monday. And I thought, over the weekend, I'll talk to people. Let me see if I can figure something out. And I remember I was stressed about it the whole weekend. And Monday came. I hadn't figured out an answer either. I was just going to ask to talk to the doctor. So maybe I misunderstood something. So Monday came. She didn't call. Tuesday, she didn't call. Wednesday, she didn't call. Thursday, I was at an event at the Federation. And this story is not, God forbid, in any way to try to talk badly about non-Orthodox Jews. And this is just how the story went. It was like a Board of Rabbis event. And this rabbi comes over to me and he says, oh, you're the rabbi at Cedar Sinai, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he says, oh, what crazy story that happened over there at that other hospital. I'm purposely changing small details. Crazy story that happened at that other hospital that, you know, they called you about. And I was like, oh, you know about that case? And he said, yeah. I said, how did you know? He said, oh, I bet they didn't call you back. They probably felt embarrassed. I was like, what happened? He said, I got a call over the weekend. They said, you know, that Rabbi Weiner is a little too, like, Orthodox. He wouldn't let us extubate in this case. What would you say? So I told her that I think it's fine. And so I said, yes, you should do it. Don't feel guilty. Don't feel bad about it. So I told her. But apparently, like, maybe because it was the weekend, she couldn't find, like, no one came to ask her, and she wasn't able to tell anyone. So a day went by that she told the resident, but he said, like, oh, I'm going off shift now. Just tell the person that's filling in for me. But then the person didn't come. Another day went by. Finally, on Wednesday, she starts noticing that his vitals are improving. And she starts, like, interacting with him. She seems to be reacting. Then Thursday morning, the morning of that event, he woke up because a brain aneurysm sometimes recedes. I'm not telling the story to say that I'm a miracle man or to try to. But 2 months later, literally, the woman walked into my office with her son. And she says to me, I want you to meet the man whose life you saved. I said, I didn't save his life. I didn't save his life. I'm not taking credit for it. But the sort of conservatism in halacha, the anxiety I had over it, who knows what would have happened if I would have said yes. But it held me back from saying, like, I'm not comfortable with just moving forward with this. And there are times, someone was asking me before, but sometimes there are things that happen in hospitals that we can't expect. Sometimes there are, I don't know if you call it a miracle, because I talked to our neurologist at our hospital. She said, yeah, it's common with children especially, and brain aneurysms, the bleeding does recede. You're supposed to give it a few weeks. So I'm just trying to show one side of the coin, this infinite value of life perspective, that there's a school of thought within halachic approaches that we do everything we can to prolong life. And there is positive value to that, because, you know, we want to respect all human life, and sometimes we want to give people a chance to survive. Okay, that's one side. Now, we turn the page, then there's the other side of the story. This perspective we call the relative value of life. Life is of, incredible value, inestimable value, but not necessarily infinite value. It's probably based on the pasuk in Devarim, "Raki shomer lecha shmor nafshecha meod, pen tishkach es devarim asher ro'i necha." Guard yourself. First of all, by the way, whenever it says "v'nishmartem meod lenafshecha," it's the only mitzvah in the Torah that's meod. That guarding your health is meod. But anyways, in this pasuk, it's guard your. Why? If it's infinite value of life, it should have just been period right there. Just guard your life because you're alive. But it says pentishkach, lest you forget the things you learn. Meaning, guard your health so that you can live a meaningful life. So that you can remember the Torah you learned. So that you can teach Torah. So that you can be involved with life that is of value to you. So there seems to be that it's like life is of value if you can fulfill your life of value. I mean, if you can live a life of value. But it's not necessarily infinite because it's pen, right? It's pen tishkach. It's guard yourself so that. And this finds support, especially in the Gemara we learned yesterday of the Amsa Debei Rebbe, when Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was horribly suffering and dying, and the maidservant, we don't need to go through the whole story again, as you know it, but she prayed for him to die and broke the jug so that his students would stop praying, and many poskim followed that approach as being the correct approach, including the Ran as a Rishon, said that we follow lehalacha, and Reb Moshe Feinstein took this and said that it's actually an obligation, that's what we follow, so much so that, quoting that story on the next page, he says, Vaday de Asur, forbidden, La'asos emsayim la'harich chayesha. It's forbidden to do things to prolong a terminal life, but often she'd be discerning if it's in suffering. V'stam ikuv yitzias ha'nefesh, and even just holding the soul back from exiting, that is who be discerning. So here's here's my line that I say, and it's based on this remotion. In fact, it's especially on the next page, the remotion in Choshen Mishpat, Chelik Beis, Siman Ayin Dalad there. One of the most common questions I get, and I'm sure you have or will get this question a lot from congregants and people who are struggling with making decisions about their health care when it's a terminal case and they're suffering. And so, as I mentioned yesterday, I don't like to be the one to say to them, you should do this, you must do that, you can't do this. But to help them frame the issues and articulate the issues and kind of figure out what matters for them at that moment and how to articulate their values. So I try to give them a one-liner that helps them to make the decision for themselves. And it helps also show where's the role of the doctor, the healthcare team, because they have a central role, and where's the role of the rabbi and the religion, because it's also a central role, and then where's the role of the family. Here's my line. I say, the Jewish approach is, because we just saw two different values. We saw the approach, the infinite value of life, the relative value of life. Then we see how Moshe takes it. We do everything we can to prolong life, but we do nothing to prolong suffering or the dying process. We want to prolong life, but we don't want to prolong dying. When we have changed from prolonging life to prolonging suffering or prolonging the dying process, that's a medical determination. We need guidance from medical professionals to help us know when this person's life is being prolonged or when their death is just simply being prolonged. That's the challenge. And just before we question, just so you see that Reb Moshe says this almost explicitly. If you look on that page, the last line of that tshuva, actually not the last line before the Gimel, he says, first of all, he says, Devade pashut ubarud v'yedua lechol ben Torah. It's obvious and clear to any ben Torah of Yer Shemayim. Shemichuyavim l'rapos l'hatzil b'masha efshar. That we should, when possible, save life. Lechol adam below shum chiluk b'chachmaso uvedato. No matter who it is, it doesn't have to be the greatest you know, person, however you judge people. Every person deserves that dignity. We should be doing whatever we can to prolong life. And by the way, there's a great book, horrible title, but I remember I once spent Shabbos when I was in Israel for the year in Sfat at these Breslover Hasidim that barely spoke English. And I remember they asked me what I was learning. I asked them what they were learning. They're like, oh, you have to read the best. I told them I was learning Masilas Yesharim. So they're like, oh, you know the best Musar Sefer? I said, what? They said, oh, you have to read it. How to Win Friends and Influence People. Yeah. Dale Carnegie. Now, the title's funny because it sounds like, oh, I'm only using people to try to influence them. But it's an amazing book. He has great advice there. Like in chaplaincy, I always think about, he has a chapter there about how to be a good conversationalist. For example, he says, to be a good conversationalist, be as quiet as possible. Just be a good listener. He's like, I have conversations with people. I barely say a word. I just ask them to tell me more. And then they're like, oh, that was great talking to you. You're so fun to talk to. People like to hear their own voice. But he has a chapter in there about how when you're talking to someone who you're trying to bring them along to agree with you, so he says, if you get them nodding and agreeing, they're more likely to continue agreeing with you. I'm not saying this because I'm trying to convince people, but my point is, oftentimes in the hospital, people make this assumption, Jewish patients, there's like this assumption, Judaism says we do everything, right? We have to do everything at all costs. That's what we say, especially, you know, from certain backgrounds, you know, people in our community, whether it's Orthodox or Persian or, you know, not trying to stereotype, but I'm just saying some people make this assumption that Judaism says to do everything. So my approach, I'm saying we do everything to prolong life, but not to prolong suffering. So that second part of the sentence, they might not agree with it. They might think like, wait, are you really a rabbi? So the first part of the sentence is important because it gets them agreed. They're like, oh yeah, see? So we're in a meeting with the doctors and they say, Rabbi, what does Judaism say? What should they say? I say, well, we do everything to prolong life. And they start saying, see, this rabbi's on our side. And I say, yeah, we do everything we can to prolong life, and we do not prolong the dying process. We do not prolong suffering. Though once we are in the dying process, and doctor, we need you to help us, guide us. If we're in the dying process, we don't do that. In fact, not only don't we do it, but Rav Moshe writes, and this is the next line here, how I said it before, the previous line, but we just read it, the truth is, but he says it else a different way here. He says, Vade dehu mishum, this will the gosis as the historian, be ikuv yitzis and nefesh, okay, that's not the line I was looking for. I was looking for the line above. Anyways, we read before where he says that it's actually usur to prolong the life. So he said in the same tshuva, it's required to prolong life and it's forbidden to prolong suffering and the dying process. It's right there in his writings. In fact, Rav Shlomo Zalman on the next page says, "She'ein chayavim la'asos ma'aseh." We're not required to prolong life. Dr. Steinberg says that he read Moshe's tshuva and he said he was going too far by saying it's forbidden. Rav Shlomo Zalman said, you're not required to prolong. But Rav Moshe said, no, it's forbidden to prolong the dying process. And so for me, this line, and that helps me put it back to the family. Okay, this is what we do. This is the principle, prolong life, don't prolong suffering. And now you can try to navigate which part are you in, you know, when have you moved to that other part. And this line, for me, has been so I find that people, the feedback I get is that it helps people and helps them articulate what they're struggling with. I see Nisa has a question, comment.
I have terrible internet, so tell me if you can hear me.
Hear you.
Okay. My question is about the woman and her son. Was there a pastoral reason you didn't follow up with her after Shabbat, or in hindsight, would you have said, like, you should have called her to check in, or I don't know, if you could tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Probably I should have. I mean, it was one of those things where I was like, I don't know what to say, I don't know what to do, and I honestly didn't really even know who she is. So it's a little bit, when you talk about pastorally, it's not like she was in my hospital or I knew her. Of course, I had her number, so I could have, and probably the right thing would have been to follow up. I just was also a little bit stuck because I wasn't sure the right thing to do, and I was assuming she was going to call me, and I thought, okay, we'll figure it out. We'll walk through this. But she just decided to go to a different rabbi. That is part of the risk, by the way, of not having a good answer or effective approach, is that they're just going to go to someone else. So, like, in some ways, I blew it. But it's a good question. I don't have a good answer.
Daniel. For people who... This is Daniel. For people
I'm just
going to
call out the names. Just letting people know you don't have to repeat.
You didn't call my name. So
he did.
Oh, he did.
For people who are... You said... So there's the line you give. First part, life. Second part, we don't prolong. The dying process. For people who take umbrage to that second part because they're not as familiar with that, with the sources, with that ethic within Torah, how... Do you try to push back on their pushback? Like, how do you have other instances where, like, that becomes...
Yeah.
Is like, do you try to take a stand and say...
Yeah, so what I usually do is ask them to talk to their rabbi. Like, I'll give an example. I'll tell you a case that I was going to share with you anyways. But is related to this relative value of life school of thought. I remember we had a patient who was in the point where we were prolonging his dying process. He was in our ICU, but he was in a dying process. We were doing everything to keep him alive. And the doctors were saying that, you know, maybe a DNR would be appropriate. And we'll talk about it in a minute when a DNR is allowed by halacha. And he called his rabbi, and his rabbi said, "Bishum ofen, Judaism does not allow, the Torah doesn't allow DNRs. You have to object to a DNR." So he said, no. But constantly we were talking as the days went by, and he said, no, I don't accept it. Then one day I was in my office, and he calls me and says, "Rabbi, I want to change my father to no code. How do we do that?" So no code means DNR. It's the same thing in hospital language. So I was like, "Are you sure?" And he was like, "Yes, I'm sure." He's like, "Let me come up and talk to you." So I went up to the room. I was like, "What changed?" He's like, "Nothing changed." I said, "I thought you said you don't want DNR." He said, no, we do not want DNR. I said, "But you want no code?" He says, "No code." I'm like, tell me what you're saying. He says, "Okay." The room next to us, we heard them all of a sudden bells ringing, and we heard them call out, "Code blue, code blue." We saw dozens of people run into the room. All of a sudden, we saw people putting lines into the arm and putting drugs, and we saw people pounding on his chest. All of a sudden, they were putting something in his throat, putting him into machines. We saw blood splattering. People were yelling in the room. The body was, you know, rocking back and forth for a half an hour. Then all just chaos. Then all of a sudden, we hear the doctor walk out and say, "Okay, time of death, you know, 10:30. And we're like, and I said, "What was that?" She said, "That was code blue." So I said, "How do we avoid that?" She says, "Well, you make the patient no code." So I said, "Okay, but do you realize code blue is... no code is DNR. It's the same thing." He said, "Oh, I don't. Could you call my rabbi? Because my rabbi is the one who told us we don't believe in DNR." And I said, "Okay, you're not going to believe the story, but." So I called the rabbi, and I said, "Rabbi told me this whole thing," and he said, "Okay." So I said, "Well, they said you said no DNR." He said, "Oh, that's what DNR stands for." He didn't know what DNR mean, what the letters even mean, and yet he was posketing for his congregants.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. So. So once he knew, though,
rabbis are bad.
Not all rabbis. But the point is, so oftentimes I'll say to people, but often, so I said, "Could you tell?" So okay, so now you understand. Could you tell him? Could you tell him? So then he got on the phone. He said, "You know what? I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Yes, it's allowed." So sometimes you have to hope that there's going to be at least some reasonableness of the rabbis, and or you know you could show them. I mean. I saw the line here that I was looking for before in the top of the page here, where Moshe says, as much as he said in that last line, that it's vaday pashut baru lechol ben Torah, that you have prolonged life, up in the top there, the first line he says, hadin hu mevoru pashut im ein yaduin harofim shum refu, if the doctors don't know any cure, lo rak lerefu aso ela af lo lehakam yisurim, that not how to cure him or relieve his suffering, just to prolong his life a little bit. They should not be prolonging such a life, and as he said on the previous page, it's actually forbidden. The next thing, but there is a next part of that line. So I say, we do everything we can to prolong life. We do nothing to prolong the dying process or prolong suffering. At that point, when we're at the point of prolonging suffering, prolonging the dying process, we transition to a compassionate approach where we provide palliative care and basic supportive measures. Rav Moshe and Shlomo Zalman, this is a little bit controversial, and there's a lot to talk about this, and we don't really have time for it, but I'm just going to mention it so you can at least be aware. I'll mention the controversy. He then says in Gimel there on the bottom, he says, but what do you have to give? Even if you're at the point where you're saying, okay, I'm not going to prolong life anymore, allow the patient to die, give them pain medications, as you know, make sure they're not suffering, which we'll talk about more in a second. But what do you have to do? Then he says, and a lot of the poskim said this, or Shlomo Zalman said the exact same thing, sorry, litain lo chamsan, oxygen, afshu ba'ofen she'efshar l'raposo, just some oxygen, shahari hu l'hakam yisurav, because somehow oxygen is seen as relieving the suffering, so we have to figure out how invasive the oxygen you have to provide is. Also, Mimashi Efshar, Lin Shom, Heim, Yasurim, Gadolim, because not breathing is very painful. And then he adds, in the next underlying piece, Pashut Shetzarech Lahachil Devarim Shein Mazikin Vein Makalkalin Devadim Machzikin Koach Me'at. You have to provide nutrition and hydration as long as it's not contraindicated. Especially with dying patients, sometimes nutrition and hydration is bad for them. It's actually going to cause aspirations, or it's not going to be absorbed, it's just going to cause infections, and it's going to cause more problems. But his argument was, the way the Polskim write it, is that there's a difference between basic routine maintenance and medications. So they argued that nutrition, hydration, and oxygen is basic needs that everyone should be provided, whereas more invasive medical interventions are not required. Not everyone agrees with this. If you saw on the source sheet we had yesterday, you saw it might have seen a piece from tradition that, from Rabbi Willig and Rav Schechter, where they don't agree that nutrition and hydration is still required for a dying patient. This was a big debate in the medical ethics world. At one time in America, we saw nutrition and hydration as a basic requirement, that everyone needs their basic needs, and it's transitioned to being seen as a medical intervention because it's artificial, artificially delivered, and therefore it's only needed if it's for a purpose. Remember, of all of this, there's an important thing to keep in mind when it comes to nutrition, hydration, and especially when it comes to ventilators. And this also can help you a lot when you're making decisions with families, which is that a ventilator is meant to be a bridge. The goal of it is to be a bridge. If someone's respiratory status is declining, such that they can't breathe on their own, but there's a hope that through a temporary assistance with their breathing through this ventilator, they will come out of the other end being able to breathe without the machine. So when they're stuck on the machine, this is really an issue for the yesterday's discussion of withholding withdrawing, but there's no point of a respirator to just prolong the dying process. There's a point of a respirator if they will live. That's why there's a clause that Rav Asher Weiss once told me, that I also use this a lot, which is that when do you have to put a patient on a respirator? So we asked the medical team, do you think there's a chance this person is going to get off the respirator, or is it going to become a destination, not a bridge? And if they think it's likely that they'll never breathe again on their own, we don't even put them on in the first place. The goal of a respirator is to be a bridge. So if it's a bridge, that's a good thing. If it's a destination that they're just stuck on this thing and deteriorating, then that's not. But so the conclusion of this statement is, we do everything we can to prolong life, but nothing to prolong the dying process. The comfort measures, I'll just mention this, I'll take your question. Comfort measures, if you look on page 5 of the Nishmas Avraham, which we have there in the corner, we had show and tell of yesterday, he writes, and this is like the classic psak in this regard, that when someone is suffering, and by the way, if you notice, well, he says it here. Look and see in where I put Nishmas Avraham, the copy of it in the bottom of page 5 of the comfort, it's actually a different page in your packets, but it just says comfort measures there. So he writes there that he says, because people might think, is morphine problematic because it might hasten death? It might suppress respiration. So can we provide morphine for dying patients or at the end of life? So he says, the halacha is, mutar litein morphine mekadomeh l'chol ha'goseis k'shezei chiyuni k'dei l'shachek et ha'ke'evim. You can provide morphine with the goal of diminishing suffering. Even though you know it might hasten their death, even still, the intention actually matters here. The intention is to relieve suffering, not to hasten death. And the truth is, sometimes it doesn't hasten death, it actually can prolong life. I think he actually says this. As long as you know that one massive dose won't certainly end the patient's life. In such a case, pain medications are allowed and probably even required. And by the way, he's not talking just about physical pain. If you see in the piece just above there, from Minchas Shlomo, he says, "Afilu sevel nefesh chazak miod." Talking about pain, physical pain, and emotional suffering, that is also taken into account. I remember just speaking this morning. We were talking about physician aid and dying. I remember one time being with a patient who was a VIP patient. I don't know if this had an impact, but I think it might have. And the patient was dying very slowly. Sometimes it's very difficult for the family when a patient dies slowly. It's just painful to watch. So they were receiving morphine, but I heard the patient's daughter asked to say to the doctor, it's agonizing watching this patient die so slowly. Isn't there anything you could do? So I'm not a doctor. I was just in the room. So he was like, I understand. Yes, no problem. And he had a very big IV syringe, and he pushed the thing, the whole thing in, and like 3 minutes later, she died. To me, it was very clear what happened, and the daughter said, thank you, and he was like, no problem. So that, I think, was what Rasul was almost talking about when he said, as long as you know that each dose won't certainly kill the person. Like, that was a lot. But when we're giving morphine in such a way that it's like, it's for pain management, it might hasten death because they might slow down their breathing, but it's because they're suffering. It's what they call in Catholic bioethics, actually, double effect, the law of double effect. You can, like, I think we were talking about before, amputations. Amputations, on the one hand, it's not good to remove your, do you want to remove your leg? No, but if it has the effect of saving your life, then it's a good thing. So double effect is it matters what the intention is. Yeah.
Recently, I think more and more psychedelics have been used for treating like various
yes.
kinds of things,
right.
including like terminally ill patients,
right.
to help them like come to terms with the dying process. I'm curious,
right.
do you think Shlomo here, the field of Sylvan Nefesh, Chazak Ma'od, is like a blanket, like heter to provide that kind of treatment for people who are terminally ill?
You could imagine that he would, right? You could imagine that there would be such a, if it's clinically proven to work, and there's very promising evidence that that's what relieves the person's suffering, then, you know, that's what they need. You could imagine such a.
Sorry, you said this. It sounds like the Chazon Ish again. As long as it's within the same one act, there's a duality, and you can say you're saving as well as killing.
Uh huh.
You're okay.
Interesting. Yeah, maybe it does fit into that same approach. It's an act of saving, not an act of killing, even though it might hasten death.
Exactly.
That it's the purpose is to save life.
Yeah.
And therefore, especially someone who's suffering, we don't want them to suffer, so therefore it's allowed.
Ilan.
I mean, the in terms of the differentiation between prolonging life versus prolonging death and suffering, I mean, again, obviously, like, the story that comes to me in mind is Fananya ben Taranya, which that was like very clearly something that was not prolonging his life, but was like not only was it prolonging his suffering, the wolves was there to prolong the suffering, like that is
right.
Dafka what it was for. And I mean, you say how like there's this differentiation here, and I might have missed this or misunderstood, but I mean, is that differentiation something that's also made in like medical terms, like? Or is that just something that's like a halakhic like concept? And like when do you make that call that this is no longer prolonging life and this is just prolonging suffering?
Yeah, well, it is a medical distinction, and yes, you definitely hear it. We hear our palliative care physicians talk that way. That there are ways to determine when a patient is moving towards a dying process. Now, obviously, there's a gray area that it might be that we. Err on the side, or maybe I err on the side when we're in the gray area of prolonging life. But sometimes you get to the point where you see that it's really you're moving towards just prolonging the suffering, and then that's a problem. Especially if we say that it's usher to do so. It's not just that not right thing, but it's actually forbidden. So we have to be careful both ways. But
so it's like relatively obvious.
It's not necessarily obvious. There's a lot of gray, and
I mean, at a certain point.
At a certain point, it becomes obvious.
Yes.
Yeah. Oftentimes, we err on the side of prolonging life, though, when it's totally uncertain.
Sarah.
Are there other areas, either like in medical or like end of life, or just other areas you can think of where like the intention matters, even though you're kind of it's like a little bit of a fallacy, or it's like a not like kind of a fact on the case, but your intention is what matters.
I could think of. I think you think of examples, think about yesterday, the discussion we had with Reb Moshe about if the tank is taken off for a medical reason, even though your goal was to allow the patient to die, so you can't take it off. But if it's taken off for a medical reason, then you don't have to replace it. So it was like, as long as the goal wasn't to kill the person, you can allow them to die from it. I mean, we had a case, maybe this is a relevant example, and it's maybe relevant for the discussions you've been having this week. We had a patient who was in his 50s and had some kind of horrible infection, and it actually progressed towards brain death. and he worked in a hospital, and his family, his wife was a nurse, two of his children were doctors, and another child was a nurse. And there is a Haredi family. And we had this meeting, a family meeting, to explain to the family that they were likely to declare him brain dead. And we know in our hospital, like many hospitals, I'm sure in New York, certain when Haredi patients are declared brain dead, we usually don't withdraw everything right away. We try to accommodate their religious values because they oftentimes don't accept brain death. So our staff is just making these assumptions and just saying to them, like, but since you don't accept brain death, we won't withdraw everything right away. And the wife of the patient said, well, what do you mean I don't accept brain death? So we said, oh, do you? She was like, well, my rabbi doesn't, but I do. She was like, I asked my rabbi. He said, no, we don't accept brain death, but I work in a hospital. I understand what it is, and therefore I accept it. Ooh, wow. So we said, well, what do you want to do? Did you ask your rabbi what we can do? He said, yeah. My rabbi said, you can't withdraw anything. If he's declared brain dead, he's not dead. But if for a medical reason something has to be stopped, you don't have to restart it. So we thought, well, nothing's going to be stopped, though, because that's the whole point. So the wife had this idea, because she was working in the hospital. I thought this was brilliant. This gave us a whole new approach. She said, well, how are you going to declare brain death? So the doctor said, well, we're going to do an apnea test. And the wife knew how an apnea test is done, which is that the respirator stays on, but it's turned off. The machine's off, and it's off for 6 minutes, and then they take blood in order to see how much the CO2 went up. If the CO2 in the blood went up to a certain level, and they can see on the respirator if they've initiated any breaths. It will show if they try to initiate a breath. If they didn't initiate any breaths after 6 minutes and their CO2 has gone up, that shows that their brainstem is not working, because your brainstem will try to breathe if its CO2 is so high. So she said, if you're turning it off for that reason, to do the apnea test, which you just told me, you have to do that test. So if he fails the test, why do you have to turn it back on?
Wow.
So the doctor was like, will your rabbi be okay with that? So she turns to me, she was like, what do you think he'll say? I was like, well, he already told you the principle, right? The principle is, if it's turned off for a medical reason, she was like, yeah, he's probably going to say no, but the principle is, yeah, the we can follow the principle. And I said to her, a patient asked me to call Rav Shmuel, Kamenetsky in Philly. Thank you. Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky with the Shiloh. And he suggested that. I remember this like 10 years ago. So I said to her, you know, I remember getting this sock once before. She says to the doctor, can we do this? She's like, you know, there's a machine. Usually we send the blood. It takes like a half an hour to get the results. But let me see if we can get the results here. And long story short, we got the results. And we did that. And and afterwards, you know, because I had mentioned her at one point. I was like, you know, there is a rabbi in your community who accepts brain death. Should we call him? She was like, no, it's not right to call. I don't want to shop around. But we did this. So anyways, I think that was an example. It was like,
wait,
it was done.
The results of the apnea test?
He failed the apnea test.
Okay.
They declared him dead at that moment. The family then came in, but he was still, his heart was still beating. So the family stepped out for the apnea test. I stayed in, partially because I just wanted to watch it. I just wanted to see. And I also told them I'll say Tehillim in the room and stuff like that. And we called them back in. We said vidui around the bed and, you know, said Tehillim and things like that. After he's been declared dead medically, but by then, we're going to rely on the not being brain dead. We stayed there and sang to him until his heart stopped, which is only like half an hour. His heart stopped, and then we called Havrigdisha. But it was an interesting example both of like creativity and like it depends. Sometimes the reason and the, you know, is relevant.
Dimitri.
Can I just ask, when his heart stopped, did you notice anything physically that his body do anything? Or because he was just
we only knew from the monitors. After the heart stops, you can start to see the skin color changes and things start changing.
There was no like, I don't know, about or like
no, that. Not so. He was brain dead. Brain
so
patients.
Like even that's it, like just zero, nothing.
No.
If you have a monitor, you'd have no idea until afterwards,
right.
And then you see the.
Right. Thing. Yeah. The one other thing. So I'm just trying to give you this. The point of this year is just to give you like the basic principles, and I'll just conclude with some like just some interesting side points that I want to share with you that I think are interesting. Hopefully, and then we'll wrap up. The last thing is. When is DNR allowed? Because this is another question you'll get a lot. People will say to you, when does Judaism allow DNR? Because that rabbi, who didn't even know what the words mean, means just FYI, do not resuscitate.
So
just for the record. Right. Yeah. Close.
Is that the same thing as DNR?
Yeah, DNI means do not intubate. Usually they come together. Usually it's DNR, DNI. But sometimes you can distinguish. Sometimes they're willing to distinguish. But DNR, we allow it in basically three cases. But in the on the next page where I wrote DNR, it's also initial savram. He gives five categories of when it's allowed, though those five are really three. And he says, here's when it's allowed. I think you'll see what I mean when you look at them. He says, mutter rak im kulam kayamim. Here's when a DNR is allowed. Because there is a big misconception in the Orthodox community, I think, that DNR is never allowed. And that's not true at all. So here's when it's allowed. Number one, machlato chashukat marpe. There's no cure. The person has a terminal illness. V'huba matzav sofani shel machlato. They're in the end stages. He does not give a time. He doesn't say in the last 3 days, in the last 2 months. It's just end stages. Doctors can help you figure out when a patient has reached that stage. They're in the final phases of the dying process. Number two, hachola sovel meod. They're suffering. Bein b'mechina fizit or b'mechina nafshit. Physically or spiritually. Lim rochim makabo tipul lahakel sivlo. Even though they're receiving medications. And by the way, as we suffer Moshe, spiritual suffering can include being in a coma. That can just be holding the neshama in the body when it's trying to leave. That could be suffering. So they are terminal. They're suffering of some sort of suffering.
By coma, you mean persistent vegetative state, right?
They're in a dying process. So we don't have to define it as PVS, meaning PVS is a certain medical definition. But someone who's not alert for whatever reason
and is dying
in the dying process, whether that's still a month before they're about to die, but like their body is shutting down. So once their soul is trying to leave, especially when they're in the ghost phase, that's when the Ramah said their neshama is trying to leave and holding it back is causing pain. So apparently Rav Eliashiv disagreed with that. It was a big debate with Rav Eliashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman, but I follow Rav Shlomo Zalman. Yeah, let's just finish this. And then number three, it's okay, you can interrupt. Gimel, kol tipol efshari lo yarich et chayav rak b'midat ma. Even if you did do some kind of medical intervention, it would only prolong their life by a small amount of time. Vagam yosif lasivlo, but also will prolong their suffering. Niskab el psak halacha be'inyan mi posek mufak. You got a psak from a posek. That's why I don't know if I really count this one, but whatever. You asked the shayla. Muvan me'alav she'achola lo hevi et da'ato she'rotze ha'rachat chayim gam b'tanayim elu. If the patient wants to, the patient could say, I'm dying and suffering, but I want my suffering to be prolonged. I want to endure it. So if they want to endure it, they say, you know what, there's a wedding in the family coming up or whatever, do whatever you can, I don't care how much suffering, I want it. So okay, if they want it, they could have the DNR, they could not be DNR, but assuming that they don't want it, which, by the way, Reverend Moshe writes us, if you don't know what they want, we usually assume that if a patient is suffering and dying, that they would not want to be resuscitated in such ways that cause so much pain and suffering and is usually ineffective.
So there's like a list of people and I have some of it in my head. So if people who are like now raising their hands can hold off for 1 second. I've got Sarah, Dimitri, Josh, and Tadek.
I want to, it's not related to this specifically, so I'll ask after this conversation.
Okay, Dimitri?
Are these ands or ors?
Ands. They all have to be included together. Okay. By the way, about the posek one, just mention one point as we go to the next question. Even though, he says you have to ask a posek, just one thing that I've learned that I just would share with you because it's been like a lesson to me. I've noticed that whoever I call, I sort of have, it's based on how accessible they are. Mm-hmm. And I've also found like when people show appreciation to me, it's for being accessible. Like one of the most important things as a spiritual leader that you can do is being accessible. It means a lot to people. I know that you have to think about work-life balance and things like that, but it is very beneficial. And I end up, you would think like, oh, you have to call the best posek, you have to call the right posek, but it ends up often being the person that you know will be reachable. It ends up being a really, really important practical rabbinic
Josh.
Guidance.
Aaron, I see you.
How far away is this definition of DNR? At what point in a normal medical situation, if you do doctors determine that it's right to use DNR?
Oftentimes, doctors give autonomy to families to make this decision. They do start encouraging it once a patient is in a dying process. But, looks like they're going to be dying. There's no cure. I mean, the truth is, it's pretty much the same thing because once the reality that there's no cure and that'll be ineffective. So sometimes you have a patient who's very frail and very weak, and the resuscitative efforts will just break their bones.
Yeah.
and it won't be effective. So sometimes they start encouraging it then. So that might be one thing that he didn't mention that here as one of the things. It was just that that they're dying. Sometimes they'll add that. It might be earlier for certain patients.
Because it seems to be that, at least until I honestly came to the seminar, I assumed that DNR was, if you cited DNR, kind of the doctors give up quickly.
Well, there have been some studies that patients with DNRs get slightly less nursing attention. And some people have expressed concerns about DNR for that reason. So it's not supposed to be that way. And so we can encourage it. Often it's having family or someone there to advocate for the patient can mitigate that. But it is one reason that there's sometimes reluctance for DNR. So they have to find ways of making sure that nurses or whoever it is are paying attention to the patient, because it's also not necessarily in their benefit to have chest compressions if they're dying as well. So to figure out exactly, you know, when to do it and how to navigate that.
Ty.
It seems to me that this fifth point is an important nafkamina between Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman about whether it's usur to extend the suffering of the patient versus whether you're not obligated to extend the distance.
Can you remind us what the fifth point is, Tiger?
The fifth point is that if
the patient wants
it, is the patient's will not to continue their suffering, but if their desire is to continue, then you're allowed to sign DNR. You're allowed to not sign DNR.
Right.
And if Rav Moshe doesn't think that, if he does think that the patient has the autonomy, where does he base that?
I mean, that's interesting, because the Rav Moshe writes the same thing. He says that if the patient doesn't want it, you don't have to do it. At the same time, he says if the patient does want it, you can do it, even though it's usur to prolong life of suffering. But apparently, there's a difference between pain and suffering. Pain is physical, is pain. Rav Soloveitchik writes about this one place where he writes that, like, pain could be like, let's say you could imagine like childbirth being very painful. I mean, this is more for women to talk about, but not necessarily suffering the same way. That's his argument, because it's pain that someone wants to endure. Whereas someone who gets a cancer diagnosis, he argues, that could be a lot of suffering, but not physical pain. A person can feel the same way before their diagnosis, after. Like, suffering is existential, emotional. So you could imagine that what Moshe means here is that if a person is willing to endure it, so then that's not suffering, even though it's pain, but they're not suffering, so then clearly that's not suffering, so they can endure it. But if they didn't want to, then you can't force them through it, because then they don't want it, and then it's suffering. It's interesting.
The line has gotten a little long now, so I'm going to say the names that I see, and then we'll get to it. I've got Aaron, Yehudit, Nisa, Nehemia, Sarah, and Ariel. I got it. Aaron.
Maybe I'm missing something basic here, but I'm struggling to understand where the Hava Amina comes from that DNRs would never be okay, just culturally. I mean, it seems to Lichora be the very definition of withholding care.
Right, that's true. If we distinguish between withholding and withdrawing, this is just withholding, not withdrawing. People see DNR as being like, there's some kind of a cultural perception that DNR means like killing the patient and giving up on them, and it's a very bad thing, and you hear from people all the time, you know, DNR is a horrible thing, stay away from that. There, for some reason, it developed. Maybe there was a time when it was being used too aggressively.
Wasn't the voice that said, we just keep on going?
Yeah, those in the school of thought that we started out with, from those who have the principle of life is of infinite value, there were posts that said, you know, even just try. Why not try to prolong life, even in a few minutes? Rabbi Bleich, who's one of those, has a piece in one of his books. He says, oh, my aunt was in a hospital for months, and I walked to the hospital one week and made kiddush for her, and I realized that kiddush that I made was more valuable than like a whole lifetime for some people. And so the fact that we kept her alive for another weekend, you know, was inestimable value. And so it was worth it to prolong her life. Like, if you see life that way, so some people might see, you know, that might be where it comes from. I don't know. You're right, because it just should fit in clearly to it's just withholding, not withdrawing, and it should be permissible. Maybe it's just used inappropriately sometimes.
Yehudi.
As far as I remember, in New York, if you enter a hospital, regardless of what you're doing, even if you're just going for a specific procedure, they give you the packet of with a DNR.
Well, with the option to sign
it. There's an option to sign DNR. So if, in this case, coming from DNR is never, you know, allowed, let's say a person has or has get proxy, that a person has a home and they have DNR signed on.
Right.
So how would that be treated from the halakhic perspective?
Sometimes it's inappropriate. Sometimes people have in their advance directive or their post form, I don't know what it's called here, maybe most form, that that they do not want to be resuscitated, but they could be resuscitated and survive for a full life, and they would be fine. Like that would be problematic halakhically.
Options over there, like DNR in case
right.
that there is this.
Yes, DNR. Right. Only if I am in the dying process or suffering, then it's appropriate.
Is that how
and
the form looks?
It's also okay.
Yeah. We don't encourage that type of advance directive. An advance directive that lists specific interventions is very dangerous, because then you leave it to doctors to determine for you when you can't speak for yourself what they're going to give you, what they're not going to give you, when you don't know when you write the advance directive what you're going to be going through, what stage of life you'll be in, what your illness will be, what possibilities there are. We just created an advance directive. You could check it out. There's an organization, AMATI, you're going to be hearing from them. And we created an advance directive called Nativot that Rabbi Shlomo Brody and I just published. Actually, Rabbi Schacht and Rabbi Willig signed off on it, that they approved of it. And we just based it on values. We just said, tell us about your values, but don't tell us your specific desires, and help your rabbi and your proxy determine in every situation what's the right thing, but without giving specific medical interventions listed.
What if this paper also lists next of kin or yes. whatever it is, that they should first consult them,
right.
and then if
yes.
this is in line with my values,
right.
then
exactly.
That's okay.
Yes.
Nisa.
Good question.
Nisa, you hear me?
Okay. Yeah. Checking my internet.
We can hear you.
Okay. Good. So maybe it's more of a clarification question. When the Nishmat Avram talks about the suffering, like that's nafshi, and nowadays we understand bryut nefesh as mental health, so there's no way to really determine spiritual suffering. So do you think it may be saying that it's more about like psychological suffering?
Definitely.
Would that be helpful?
Yes. No, I definitely think that's what he's referring to. He's referring to emotional and mental health. Yeah. For sure.
Sarah Singer.
So my question was about the sort of like all of those criteria being cumulative, that somebody has to meet all of them for a DNR to be appropriate.
Right.
But would that like include, so if we have someone who's not terminally ill, but they are under the age, or like technically they're frail in some way, where that any attempt at resuscitation is so unlikely to be successful,
right.
and the chance of causing harm and suffering is so high, like, would it be appropriate for someone who's, you know, 95 or older to say, yeah, I'm not sick, I could continue living, you know, years, but if my heart stops spontaneously, the odds that you get me back are so low, like, don't, you know, try to break my ribs in the final moment.
Yes, very good. So from this, it implies that they have to have a terminal illness, right? But, I had a case like this with a patient who had advanced dementia, but not necessarily going to die within a year or any time that we knew coming up. And so, we thought a DNR would be appropriate, but the post-sick we asked in Los Angeles felt like, well, it doesn't fit all these principles. They don't have a terminal illness. So I called Rav Usher Weiss in that case, and he actually wrote me a tshuva where he argued that it's not specific. We don't have to be specific about the terminal illness. Exactly the way you framed it in terms of frailty and inability to thrive and sort of like a prolonged suffering in that's incurable, that could also be included in this. And it doesn't just have to be terminal. So that also kind of expands these boundaries here.
Ariel.
Similar to what Nisa was asking about before, in terms of spiritual suffering, existential suffering, psychological, emotional, like, I'm wondering how we measure that and how that kind of suffering maps onto questions of psychological distress and illness.
Yeah, I don't know that we have like specific criteria of how to measure it. It's measured like very subjectively. It's sort of like, well, it seems like they're suffering emotionally, and so that's enough. Like, we're not so strict about it. As long as it seems that there's some kind of suffering involved, it's true that we sometimes maybe would benefit from a little bit more guidance, because I sometimes go over this with patients, with families, and they're like, well, they are terminal, but I don't really see that they're suffering. They don't seem to be suffering. And this ends up being a little bit of a sticking point, even emotionally suffering. Even if we say that the soul being stuck in the body is suffering, like sometimes that ends up being a little bit of a challenge for us, but we kind of are expansive with how we define emotional suffering and pretty lenient about it from my experience. But you're right. It's a good point to bring up.
Jeff,
so I'm going to ask you three questions. You could totally choose what you want to do. For instance, can you say a word about withdrawal of nutrition, hydration, and oxygen, which I don't know if I heard correctly. Second question is the double effect the same thing as English cabinet secretion?
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then it's so fascinating to me to you, that in thinking about Rabiat's this notion of infinite human life, as the more liberal approach,
yeah,
and then you're going to end up being the more conservative approach. I don't know if you ever spoke about it with him.
No.
Just tell them when you're arguing with
right.
them.
Right. Like to me, that's when I read something that says infinite value of life, to me, all of a sudden it's like, okay, that's a very conservative approach. That's why I try to just use the word slightly differently. Instead of saying the word infinite, because infinite has certain implications, but that it's of inestimable value, of incredible value, something like that. Like, but
okay. So that's are you okay with if you're really willing to treat nutrition, hydration, and oxygen as medical intervention, would you withdraw it in any case?
Well,
would withdraw respirator?
Yeah. So the approach that Rabbi Schechter takes on this, where he says, like those interventions that can be allowed to run out, nutrition when it's in a bag and coming through an IV, you can let the bag run out and not refill it. So those Polsky moves say that you have to provide at all costs. They also, though, agree that if it's not effective or if it's counterproductive, it could be removed or switched to a less invasive. So sometimes we say, you know what, we don't need to have like a G-tube in their stomach, but just basic IV hydration, just so they don't die of starvation, they die from the underlying illness instead, that could be enough. So from those posts, that's what we follow. Otherwise, we can say that we can let the bag just run out. It's not removal, it's allowing to run out. It usually doesn't take that long, so it's not, yeah.
I've got Josh, Daniel, Miriam, Sarah, and Nehemiah. Josh.
On a more practical level, how do you go about asking shilohs of like Rav Asher Weiss and other luminaries?
Well, the people who, everyone has their way of being easiest to reach. Like there's Rav Ullman in Australia, is a Lubavitcher postdoc, who's an extremely broad-minded and really interesting thinker, very unique person. And WhatsApp, Rav Rimon, WhatsApp, Rav Asher Weiss, his cell phone. You know, it's like, it depends, each person, trying to know what time of day for certain people. In L.A., there's a post, Rabbi Sauer, there's a post like, right, I know what time he gives a shiur. Other than that, he always will answer his phone.
They'll answer unknown numbers? Or
I don't know.
Do you have a relationship with those people? They see,
I know
Jason
them.
One,
I actually called Rav Asher Weiss when he was sitting Shiva to be Menachem Avil. And he answered his phone. He goes, Rabbi Weiner, I'm sitting Shiva now. If it's Pekuach Nefesh, I can answer. I was like, no, it was to be Menachem Avil. He's like, oh, okay. So I see that he sees who it is. I don't know, because Rabbi Sauer told me in L.A., he says, whenever I see your number come up, I say a little tefillah, like, Hashem, help me. This is going to be the life and death question. He's like nervous that, you know, what am I going to ask? But.
Daniel.
So my question is, going to DNRs and your like work as a chaplain, is that something that's frequently asked of you, your opinion on should they do it, like when you go visit, is that something families bring up, or is that something that sometimes you'll bring up?
Often I see it's very common. Oftentimes I see the doctors, when they want to help the family understand the reality of the patient's dying is coming, but they realize the family's not going to be willing to withdraw interventions and hasten their death, they see a good compromise of saying, you know what, let's just at least have a DNR so we don't prolong suffering if it comes to that, and we can, as a compromise, maintain. So this is like a common application of it.
Are there cases where you bring it up because it hasn't been addressed adequately?
Yeah, could happen. Sure, definitely. Yeah. I'll tell you, and then we'll go to the next question, but just another example of post-scheme and how important it is to be responsible. And then we have to wrap up soon, too. We had a case of a brain-dead patient who was from a Lakewood community, and they weren't accepting brain death. The patient was being prolonged for a long time, and their post-sec had told them that everything should be done to prolong the life of the brain-dead patient. And the doctors at one point said, well, what about antibiotics? I thought that's crazy to provide antibiotics for a brain-dead patient. So they said, well, we need to ask a shiloh. they called Rishlomo Miller in Toronto. He's a big, very big Lakewood Posig. And he asked him to talk to me. He didn't know who I was. He just kind of talked to the chaplain. He was wanting to talk to someone in the hospital. So he gets on the phone. He says, let me ask you a question. They want to know about antibiotics. He says, from my opinion, I would tell them, yes, provide antibiotics, provide everything. But it all depends on one thing. You know the ICU staff. They had already told him, the rabbis involved. So he said, in your ICU, I thought this was brilliant. This is beautiful, I think. He said, well, if we demand antibiotics and we're really aggressive about it and we get them to give it, and the staff feels that, you know, we have to fight for it, will it have a negative impact on future patients who also are making religious accommodation requests? Because will the staff start to see us as being, like, annoying? Or do you find that the staff is happy to do it? And I said, Rabbi, the staff is already annoyed at them. And part of their annoyance is because of the last patient who was brain-dead, Orthodox patient, who we had to prolong their life. And it annoyed them so much that it's, like, triggering them already. He said, okay, in that case, put him back on the phone. He gets back on the phone. He says, no antibiotics. So that was amazing. The halacha depended on how it impacted other patients and the staff, which I thought was very profound.
Sarah.
Just curious what you're just about Bidui, because I know Rav Jeff isn't as fond of it, so I can ask him another time, but how do you view Bidui? Or do you have any problems with it?
I think Vidui is a beautiful opportunity to bring family together and say a prayer that's really beautiful. Sometimes it could be scary for people, so it depends how we couch it. We always couch it in terms of there's a beautiful prayer that we say at this time that's customary to say that we believe is a merit for the neshama. It doesn't necessarily mean someone's dying. Many people say Vidui multiple times. Every time they go for a surgery, they say Vidui. We often couch it as I often will say the Hebrew, but I'll first say the English. I'll say, like, first we're going to thank God for this person's life. Could you share it? And I ask people, share a little bit about some of the things that they have to be thankful for. Okay, now we're going to pray for this person. We're going to say, you know, blessing. All of you, please give a blessing to the patient. You know, now we're going to ask for forgiveness and clear the slate. Is there anything that you want to, you can say it quietly if it's embarrassing. Is there anything you want to forgive them for or ask for forgiveness? I think it can be a beautiful opportunity when done carefully, to really bring about a lot of really beautiful. I learned actually from Ravavi that to like do singing at that, a lot of singing can be really special moments.
You want to say a word about the fellow who wanted to tear Kriya? Or is that not Shaddach? The guy who had torn Kriya early?
Oh, you remember that story?
No.
that was a long time ago. So not all rabbis are experienced. I've mentioned this a few times. So rabbis aren't always experienced in hospitals. So I remember a patient had called me to see him to say Vidui with them. So I went up to say Vidui. But when I got there, he says, my rabbi already did it with me over the phone. So I said, okay, great. But then I noticed his shirt was torn. So I noticed the patient's alive. So I was just confused. I didn't want to say anything. So I went out and I called the rabbi. And I was like, Rabbi, what happened? What did you do with the patient? I said, you said Vidui? I said, I have to be honest. I'm a Kohen. I'm not sure what I did. I opened up the Madrich and we read through the whole Vidui. He says, let me see it. He says, oh, shoot. It says here, after the Neshama departs, say this part. We said it before. It's actually prohibited by the Shulchan Aruch, as we read yesterday, to tear Kriya when a person's still alive. It scares them. And the father was somewhat alert, not totally, but somewhat alert. And he's sitting there in the room, already torn Kriya. The guy's alive, but the rabbi didn't know because he's a Kohen.
This would be terrible.
terrible. Yeah, I forgot about that story.
Miriam.
Thank you so much. First of all, after yesterday, I am so relieved. This is so, I mean, your approach is so wise and so compassionate.
Oh, thank you.
From all sides. I think for someone like, you know, being a rabbi, but also being just in this kind of situation where you face that possibility, it's just relieving psychologically that there are like different ways things can maneuver. I don't want to go into detail here. But now I want to go back on the other side that I was and say, can pain and suffering also incorporate, prolonging pain and suffering also incorporate the feelings of the family and surrounding friends in case person is already unconscious, I mean, basically brain dead, I should say.
Yeah.
Meaning, can we say also this pain and suffering of the family, and maybe that also could be a...
It's a hard, it's a difficult question, because we're not supposed to, because that's the initial sovereign right there in that piece, like in the next page. He says this is all supposed to be focused on the patient's pain and suffering. If the patient is not, but the family is, we don't make decisions based on what's better for the family. It's supposed to be based on what's better for the patient. So it's a difficult question, but that's technically what they say.
Nehemiah,
how do you take care of your well-being? It's okay to ask if you're dealing with so much, so much death.
Yeah, it's a very good question.
It's not the Chevra Kadisha where you get it when it's already dead, when you get the body that's dead.
That's hard work, too.
Actually, a lot of times you see the patients when they're alive, and then you see them die. So,
I mean, for me, part of like why I'm so into medical ethics and like these decisions and calling rabbis and writing books, it's like that's my self-care. It's like to keep it interesting and make sure like it's, you know, analyzing it and thinking it through. But it is an important issue. We have in my department, we created, everyone is required to have a self-care plan. And we have self-care buddies that we have to check in with on a regular basis. And we created these like these worksheets that are like emotional, physical, mental, like different aspects of well-being. What do you do for yourself? What nourishes you in these areas? And what is your plan to ensure that you're doing those things? So like every now and then, I just take a day off and go to the beach for the day and just read on the beach in LA. I mean, I love being at the beach. It's just so refreshing. I don't know about that will work here as much, but you can have other places. But you know, I got really into exercise. Once I started working at the hospital, I got really into running. And it's like, for me, for everyone, it's something else. But like having a self-care process is really important. Otherwise, they will burn out.
Susan.
What percentage of your patient encounters are end-of-life kinds of encounters?
It's probably 60% end-of-life encounters, I would say. Yeah, for better or for worse. Doesn't need to be. Unfortunately, it's a misconception about chaplains. We're not just there for end of life. We're supposed to be there for when people are thriving also, right? When people need to talk about, you know, these matters. But unfortunately, it's what it ends up being.
Dimitri. But, wow. I keep on thinking of gotten to the end of you guys.
Is that okay?
Please, we have... I'll tell you what. I'm going to make you the last question so that I can... talk from Jason out with blah blah before the end, and then we'll say goodbye. Thank you.
Great.
Then this will be part one of a four-part question. Part first. I'm just curious, how does this play out if at all any differently in the pediatric ward?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Or even like neonatal.
Yeah. No, and the post you write about this, that the truth is,
part two.
Or 1A, 1B.
Before delivery, when it comes to like, my child might be born with like, some kind of congenital defect, and might die immediately, I know that's like more abortion kind of question, but I'm sure this all manifests that it's not older people who are dying.
In general, with children, we tend to be, first of all, very sensitive, very careful with the parents, but we tend to be, the post-game tend to be more... more wanting to try at least to prolong life. Of course, there comes times when it's the exact same principles and we allow natural death, but we're a little bit more aggressive. In fact, I was just talking to one of our neurologists about, and she told about this whole topic. She told me, I've never had a patient who was brain dead come back. There's no such thing as coming back. She's like, except for once a baby. Once a baby, we declared brain dead, and then that baby survived. And she said that's because babies are a different category. There's just a certain resilience, and we just don't give up as easily on a baby. Yeah, exactly. Their body is just more resilient, and there's more possibilities. When someone is 96 years old and they're declining, I mean, there's certain things that you just see physiologically happening versus when a newborn baby, unless there's certain disease courses that you know with a baby also that you recognize this is there's no hope whatsoever, but we err on the side of caution a little bit more with babies.
All right, Amanda, you get the last word, and then I'm really gonna shut this down.
Thank you for taking my question. I appreciate it. I'm curious, in states where Medicaid requires one, in order to transition to hospice care, to waive the right to like curative and restorative treatments.
Right.
How do you kind of manage that from a halakhic perspective?
Well, so if they fit into the DNR category, they fit into the hospice category, meaning a patient is allowed to go on hospice by halakha if they are terminal, they're in the dying process, and they have no chance of recovery. There's no cure possible. So then they fit into hospice. So yes, hospice does not include. I don't know of any hospice that also includes curative. Some rabbis will require some of the things we mentioned before, like nutrition, hydration, basic antibiotics, things like that during hospice. But curative, the point of hospice is to help a patient die comfortably, not to hasten their death, but to allow them to die comfortably. So the goal is not to cure them. And we assume that the patient is only allowed to go into hospice if there is no hope for a cure. There was a patient who there are times when patients, like with the assisted aid in dying, I've had patients that stop taking medications in order to become terminal, so they could fit in the category. That might be more difficult to justify halakhically, but in general, it's okay halakhically. That's a good question. I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you all very much. I really enjoyed learning with all of you. I hope you'll keep in touch. Feel free to reach out anytime. I already did myself in by talking about how important it is for rabbis to be accessible, but I'd be happy to be in touch anytime and happy to be helpful if I can be helpful in any way. There's many people that help me on a regular basis, so if I can be helpful in any way, I'm really more than happy to.
Rev. Jason, I know that personally from my interactions with you that you really are available. I think I speak